government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence with Prince, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour here on BBSRadio.com, as I already said, on this June the 2nd on the West Coast, or if you are on the East Coast or in the Central Time Zone, then you know it's the early morning hours of the 3rd. Of June. June 3rd. Time is really flying. Wanted to share something with the listening audience today. If you've been following the news at all, you've heard about this crash, this complete bankruptcy now of GM. And we were warning that these billions of dollars that they were given not too long ago, a little over a month ago, would mushroom into something much more massive that they were going to ask for, which would result in losses. And, of course, we don't really know that this has occurred other than in general, people have somewhat reserved opinion about the quality of American automobiles and trucks and what have you. There are some good ones out there, and there are some very poor ones, especially when it comes to mileage. I guess you could blame that on the people that didn't make their mortgage payments as well. You could blame everything on that, if that were really true. I'm going to read something to you I thought was pertinent, and this is from my buddy Vance in Florida. It's called A Matter of Law. Economy with General Motors' long-awaited prepackaged bankruptcy finally here. America is on the verge of a new era, one where government, not investors and consumers, is the final arbiter of success. GM's bankruptcy pushes bondholders aside in favor of the U.S. government and the UAW. Though bondholders hold $27 billion in debt, they'll get just 10% of stock. How's that compare with the other stakeholders? For spending $50 billion to bail out GM, the government will get 60% of the equity in the new GM. The UAW, which along with other unions gave millions to Democrats, will be repaid for its loyalty with 17.5% of the stock for $10 billion of unsecured debts. So the government, with roughly two times what private bondholders have on the table, gets a stake five times bigger. And the union, with about a third as much invested, gets 70% bigger stake. Even the Canadian government, with its $9.5 billion invested, and that's in quotes, ends up with 12%. They call it restructuring. We call it theft. Never in our memory has there been a more thorough, systematic effort to disenfranchise the shareholders and bondholders of a major American firm. It will make investors, domestic and foreign alike, think twice about making any investment in an American stock or bond in the coming years. Why invest if your money and rights as an investor can arbitrarily be stripped from you, as they were in GM's case? But our real issue with this isn't that people will lose money, it's that we don't believe the government's actions are even legal. The White House has basically been manipulating GM into bankruptcy since early this year, putting 31-year-old Brian Deese, a Yale law student, in charge of GM's restructuring. It is not every 31-year-old who in a first government job finds himself dismantling General Motors and rewriting the rules of American capitalism, the New York Times said with tongue-in-cheek, we think. It used to be that the rules of American capitalism came from 200 years of U.S. case law, the Constitution, and legitimate federal regulation. but no more. Instead, the job's been given to someone not yet out of law school. This shows shocking contempt for GM, once the world's preeminent industrial company, for American capitalism and the rule of law. We don't think this travesty passes constitutional muster and hope to see it vigorously challenged in federal court soon. Our Constitution is very specific. It limits the executive branch's rights to those enumerated therein. The rest it grants to the people and the states. It also requires due process under the law, especially when government takings are involved. That's why in 1952, when President Harry S. Truman tried to seize control of the U.S. steel industry during a debilitating strike, the Supreme Court made him back down, and Truman had a real emergency on his hands, the Korean War. We pored over Article 2 of the Constitution, known as the Executive Powers Clause. Nowhere is the White House granted the right to override the time-tested bankruptcy process, to use Treasury money raised by taxing Americans to buy or bail out companies, to fire CEOs, to micromanage corporate policy, or to abrogate lawful contracts made by private parties. Yet, our government has done these things and more, leading to a corrupt GM bankruptcy. The damage to our system of corporate capitalism and the rule of law is severe. Next stop, federal court. And that was from the 2009 Investors Business Daily. I thank Vance for sending that in. And now you see, folks, that I am not the only one talking about corruption, and it's even reaching the mainstream magazines. With that, I would like to invite another journalist to the show. He has been on Evident Footprints a number of times since I have been on the air, and I'm very pleased to have him here. I was actually planning on giving him a call today when he shared with me a very pertinent message, a very poignant and very important message that must get out to the people in this country and presumably the people all around the world. He is the publisher, editor of the Idaho Observer, along with his better half, Ingrid Castle. My guest this evening, Mr. Don Harkins. Don, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you, Don, and thanks a lot for having me. And it's true, what I have to say this evening affects everyone, because we're going to be talking about something that has huge implications and also indicates a very devious and patient plan by the U.S. government to usurp a lot of states' rights and individual rights in order to wage another one of its unwinnable wars, which I think the U.S. government has lost every single war since World War II, declared or undeclared, overt or covert. And this one has got implications that are much, much bigger than most people would ever think.
Mm-hmm. And we want to stress to those in the listening audience who might be with the military anywhere around the world that we're not implying that it's the outcome of these wars is by any means a reflection of their capabilities to defend our country or to simply do their job. It's planned that way, isn't it, Don?
Well, absolutely. And when it comes to war, all wars are only lawful if they are to repel invasion. And any time that you aggressively and belligerently, or in the popular vernacular, preemptively, go out to another nation, a sovereign nation, meddle in its internal affairs, and wage war on them, regardless of whether it's declared by Congress or not, it's an illegal war in national, international law. And this is what our men and women in uniform have been forced to wage in their wartime capacities. And unfortunately, not once, really, even in World War II, were they utilized to repel invasion. And many suffered the ultimate price, and many came back completely damaged individuals. And plus, we have this huge infrastructure of dealing with veterans of foreign wars, and the public pays the price in money as well as culturally and socially and familially for the damages that are done for these wars that in no way have advanced the cause of freedom worldwide or protected the freedom of the American people. It's unfortunate but true, and our military people really need to begin taking stock of what they're actually participating in. And in order to do that, they're going to have to throw away the history books that they were given in high school and junior high and in grade school and look at what's really been transpiring over time to realize that General Smedley Butler was right in 1946, I believe, when he said that war is a racket, and our military people, as well-intended as they are, as patriotic as they are, have not been advancing our freedom. They've been advancing the freedom of capitalists to do a scorched earth campaign across the earth, exploiting everything in its path.
So right you are. And isn't it ironic that over the past 4 or 5 days on a number of shows that I've done either on RBN, Oracle Broadcasting, or here on BBS Radio, Major General Smedley D. Butler was brought up on each show. And in fact, on 3 of the shows, I had either participated as a co-guest or as a host or as a guest with Drew Raines, who is the great nephew of Major General Butler. So it's kind of a coincidence.
Yeah, there are no coincidences. His name does come up more and more often as people figure out that the war in Iraq, the pending war in Iran, and the ongoing war that we're waging on Afghanistan has nothing to do with American freedom or defending freedom worldwide or liberating oppressed peoples. It is purely 100% about advancing the right of the elite to downtrod upon the rights and resources of sovereign nations and their people.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And now there are those in the audience who may react to your statement about us entering wars not having been attacked. Of course, you're not really leaving out Pearl Harbor. In the sense, in retrospect, Pearl Harbor was the 9/11 of the day, wasn't it? They knew that war, that attack was going to take place.
And additionally, it's pretty well documented that the country of Japan had even sent, prior to Pearl Harbor, diplomatic envoys to the United States in order to attempt to diplomatically address the political situations that were developing that were placing Japan in an untenable position. And rather than realizing that its diplomatic policies were creating a situation that would require Japan to attack the United States in order to give the United States the justification to involve itself in the European theater in World War II, the U.S. government exacerbated the situation however it could. So it's unfortunate but true. The little-known history proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that Pearl Harbor was precipitated intentionally by the policies of the FDR administration for the purpose of justifying the United States getting into a war, which it was against because it still was reeling from the effects of World War I, which had only concluded about 25 years previously. And rather than realize that it was unpopular for good reasons, the United States created the reasons why the American people would rally behind an effort to deal with the axis of evil or the axis powers of Germany and Italy and ultimately Japan.
Mm-hmm. I got a text message from Major General Butler's great nephew that the book was, or the treaties, we'll call it, was written in 1933. So,
oh, okay.
Just for clarification.
No, I appreciate that very much. Is he on board with us right now?
Well, I got apparently a chat listening. Message. I think he's trying to listen. He's having a bit of a communications problem, but he'll probably give us a message from time to time. You know, in my research, Don, what I began to notice, and especially when I began looking at shipping records, I really followed these ships around, and I had to determine what shipping company they worked for or belonged to, these passenger ships. Some were cargo ships, and I found key people in history whose names have been changed to protect the innocent, that these people were at in some occasions working for the East India Company. Now you know they weren't delivering sugar and spices per se. Maybe a little bit of tea, maybe some cinnamon or jasmine or something like that. But primarily they were moving huge amounts of gold, arms, ammunition, soldiers, and there's another element. And I suppose if I had you take a stab at what they might have been shipping, what would you say?
I would say that the companies that have done very, very well in overseas shipping over time, of course, they're shipping dry goods and legitimate cargo, but the the balance of their profits come from the transshipment of contraband. And contraband takes on a lot of different shapes and sizes. Either it can be human cargo for sex and slavery, and it can also be illicit drugs. It can be banned substances of a non-narcotic nature as well. So I would say contraband.
Yeah, well, I wasn't quizzing you per se, but that was a very good answer. It was actually a lot more detailed than I expected. I was just hoping you would say drugs.
Drugs.
Okay. Because
could have been a one-word answer, but I embellish and elaborate. I can't help myself.
Yeah, I've written, and I know I use this phrase at least once in one of my writings, where we have this war on poverty, and we have war on racism, and we have war on terrorism, and we have war on drugs. And these are wars that cannot be won, number one, because they're not really wars, and number two, except the war on drugs is describing having a war while people are on drugs. I always interpret it that way.
Yeah, I kind of like that. That adds a little humor to the dire nature of the circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being sarcastic, and yet that's really what they mean, because they have no intention of stopping drugs. In fact, the people who get arrested for transporting drugs or for selling drugs are usually in competition with the governments and with these people that own these shipping companies and own the or control the lands where these drugs are produced. Afghanistan is a current example right now. There are reason for being in Afghanistan, besides this pipeline that runs out of the southern portion of the former Soviet Union, is to harvest the poppy fields and to control the drug trade, which is went up immediately 500%. When we invaded Afghanistan. I have no idea where that is now. You don't hear about it much anymore. But
no, you don't. But let's put into perspective the global drug trade. And let's just see who all must be involved in order for this very large international business to continue growing year after year after year. First of all, let's go ahead and pick a number off the top of our head. The T number is really popular these days. That's a trillion. Trillion here, a trillion there. Well, I believe that we could not get too much disagreement from people if we said that the global illicit drug trade is somewhere around, $1 trillion a year. That is a lot of money. So let's look at who must be involved. First of all, in order for $1 trillion to be cruising through commerce would require the international banking community. It would have to, wouldn't it? Because
absolutely.
It is a lot of cash. And
yes.
In order for it to be profitable, all that cash can't be underground. In other words, you can't have people in this circle that is churning $1 trillion just doing it in tens and twenties and keeping it under the table and buying cigarettes with it. It's a rather large sum of money, which requires absolutely the cooperation and indeed the hands-on operation of the international banking community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we can establish that. I don't believe that anybody could logically disagree with that statement. And plus, if you take a look at the way these people operate, you can just find plenty of evidence to support that scenario.
Yeah,
secondly,
well, it's dirty. I was going to say it's dirty money, and they have to clean it up. So they need each other's cooperation, and they all profit from all the schemes that are derived thereof. So
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Okay, so next, then, international banking is about 80% regulation. When I say that, I mean in that banks have balance sheets that are accountable. They have rules by which they're supposed to operate. They have government oversight. They are dealing with taxes and things like that are very government oriented. And so one could say that 80% or so of a bank's daily function and operation is meeting the requirements of government regulatory schemes, one way or another. And
mm-hmm.
that means then if we have the cooperation of the international banking community, by extension, we then have the cooperation of international government bodies.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have that. Those two components of the international $1 trillion-a-year drug trade are the international banking system and the international governments. That means then governments are formed of, run by, administrated by people. These people are officers of government. And so these people then are who are making the decisions, who are overlooking certain regulations, who are allowing certain things to slide, who are even at times drafting and passing laws that enable this kind of thing, are individuals in very high positions of power and authority in all of these governments. So we have the bankers, the governments, and indeed we have the buck stopping at the highest levels of governments. Now, understanding also that these regulatory schemes that governments put in place to regulate the flow of money, because banking is a regulated industry, like we discussed a moment ago, about 80% of it is regulated, regulatory schemes that they're dealing with, we have the international law enforcement community, which those guys would have to be also equally duplicitous in the trafficking of drugs, the enforcement or lack thereof of the regulatory schemes, and also they're not calling to account the individuals who are absolutely implicated in the flow of all this money. So I think that one can safely say that even though the entrepreneurs that are operating outside of the system periodically get busted, and the low-level dealers get busted, and the end users get busted, the fact that such a trade is so profitable is being conducted with the authority and the grace of people in the most prestigious positions of power in the world.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we think about the fact that these, you're talking about the people that are making the laws, that are telling what happens, what the penalties are, the fines, the imprisonment, and what have you. If you get caught selling drugs or transporting drugs across the borders, Yet what comes to mind, and I don't mean to digress, but I want to underscore how this is handled at the top. You had these two border guards who were arrested, Ramos and Campion, who were recently released, and it was a last-minute pardon by, I hate to say the name president, but George W. Bush.
The only pardons, I believe. The only two.
Yeah. Their particular case, for those in the listening audience that are not aware of what happened, they interceded and stopped a drug transaction that was taking place where this individual from Mexico was driving a van loaded with 743 pounds of marijuana. The individual ran, drew a weapon, and these two Border Patrol guards were defending themselves, and they shot at the individual, one of them hitting him in the buttocks. This guy was actually encouraged to come back to the United States and testify against the border guards. Now, one thing that I never heard anyone ask, especially in the mainstream media, the media picked this story up. It was somehow to impress upon us that border guards were not going to be tolerated interfering with the international drug trade. But that's not the really intended message. It was, you shoot at someone coming over the border, and you're going to prison. It was a warning to all the border guard patrol, and likely some of the military. We've heard examples of Marines or Army personnel being called into a situation where residents in southern New Mexico or Arizona have reported seeing Chinese troops coming in into our country. And these guys were high-fiving and back-slapping. So the big question is, that the media didn't ask, who was receiving that 743 pounds of marijuana? Who was that being delivered to? Who had paid for it? Who had made the arrangements for this individual to just drive into the country with a van loaded with this stuff? Now, one would presume that if the border guards hadn't seen him, that he would have likely been passed right through at the border by the customs agents. But he wasn't crossing in at that particular area, so he probably didn't expect to get caught. But here you have an example where you have prosecutorial abuse in the case of prosecuting these two border guards, and actually giving this guy leniency, complete just immunity from prosecution. It's insanity that would occur. And they say there's a war on drugs. Okay, I ask you, Don, who is on drugs?
I'm not sure if the war is on drugs, but maybe perhaps the people who are enforcing and waging it are.
Yeah, now, I didn't
also,
mean...
And also, if I may, let me embellish on that just a little bit, too. Going back a little bit of time, I've been in the opposition media business since 1995, and although I don't do as much of that these days because our editorial perspective has changed such, in the first 10 years or so, I spent quite a bit of time, for various reasons, investigating different counties in the United States, primarily in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, but I also did some work in Virginia and in New York. And what I found, and this is for, it could be a child abuse or a child custody case, it could be a code enforcement case, it could be somebody's getting screwed over in the theft of their property through the county machinery, or their business is being trashed because they're in competition with somebody with more political authority locally than they had. But for whatever reason, I'd go in and I would get the story, and when I would investigate the story and get down and follow it to the very end to find out what was really going on, I'm going to say something that is in violation of general semantics because I'm going to use an allness statement, but it's a very, very important point. And that is that in every single case, every county that I investigated. And I'm pretty sure that this is a good enough statement to extrapolate out to every county in the United States. Every county in this country is run by vice. Every single county has a sheriff, a prosecutor, and a judge who is actively participating in the large-scale trafficking of drugs, or they are the puppets of people behind the scenes who are pulling their strings to facilitate this kind of behavior. And so I just want everybody to make it I want to make it perfectly clear to everybody that no matter how you revere or respect the pillars of your community, the likelihood is that they are absolutely complicit in the large-scale trafficking of drugs. And then when they have a drug problem in their county and they expand police power and they get more toys and they do more enforcement, it's a show that they're putting on to make people think that they're hard on crime and hard on drugs when they, in fact, are the ones that are supplying the trade in their region. And that, I know that's a rather radical statement, but I dare anybody to defy me on it, because if I spent, about 4 or 5 days in any county in this country, I could find out for sure whether I'm correct or not, and I bet that I am.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've witnessed some of the DARE programs. In fact, there were a few instances where I actually performed music there, in conjunction with the education that, let's say middle school age, kids would be getting. But you have to ask yourself, number one, the program, if it means what they say it means, and if it does what they say it does, would work. We wouldn't have the problem that we have. By the time these kids grow up into adulthood, they've made a decision if the program is effective. Now, with the hauls that they're making in drug busts, does it seem logical that they would say, well, they have to back down with the DARE program, they have to trim it down or stop it entirely because they don't have the funds to pay the officers that do this work? It seems to me that that's a bit disingenuous when you mention trillions of dollars. You could never spend that much money in a lifetime, paying people to do a job. It's just impossible.
No kidding.
You know, in fact, many, many people in a lifetime, you would still have money left over. So we're talking about massive amounts of money, and basically what it is, unfortunately, even though there may even be police officers that feel that they're doing the right thing in heading the DARE program, they are actually aiding and abetting in the brainwashing and the mind control and the propaganda that goes on, because the very people they claim to be doing this for are directly involved, according to what you just said.
Well, absolutely. In fact, the DARE program, the acronym I use is Drug Awareness Recreation Education instead of resistance, because they're just parading it out to kids. It's a little bit like sex ed, you know, showing kids what gay sex is like when they're in grade school or junior high, when they're not even thinking about this kind of thing yet. It's perverse beyond belief, absolutely. And it's also significant, I think, if what I said was true, and I'm completely backing it up with everything that I've been involved with in the last 15 years, is that the pillars of every county gain their political power not because they're good people in the community. It's not because they've been successful in business. In legitimate business. It's because they've put themselves in positions where they're involved in this covert war on the American mind and people, and ultimately their freedom by flooding this country with drugs. And in fact, Iran-Contra proved that, I think, pretty well. Oliver North proved that they were smuggling tons of cocaine in from Central America, landing it in Mena, Arkansas, and throwing it out on the street, grabbing the profit, and using this off-budget money for black ops to arm the Iraqis against the Iranians. I mean, it's right there. The Iran-Contra hearings prove that the United States is the world's largest and, I guess at this point, more successful drug dealer.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. Yeah.
Just read the transcripts. I mean, if you can stomach months and months of that stuff, that is the lesson that you receive. It's not veiled, even, if you pay attention to what was actually said.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, you published in the May edition of the Idaho Observer a really well-written article written by Dwayne R. Olson. And I know that this article and what Mr. Olson had to say in it had a lot to do with your coming on the show tonight and this urgent message that you want to deliver. Would you care to share something about Mr. Olson for the listening audience? And I'm not even sure you want to discuss that article, but think that that's...
I very much do.
Okay.
Because it is well written. It was... I've been corresponding with Dwayne Olson for about 5 years now. He's 80 years old, and he's been in prison since he was 60. He's been in for about 19 years now, and he's in Miami, Florida, Federal Corrections Institution there. And he was busted for weed a long time ago, and I even sent a paper to a guy at his request who received, he had a greenhouse and was into having a little bit of weed around, and kind of a small-scale dealer among friends and stuff, and was at a warehouse that was a big setup, and he went away for life, for a first-time nonviolent violation of possession of weed with intent to sell. But instead of the 15 pounds or so that he was going to acquire, they charged him with having all 4,000 pounds of weed, which never even showed up as evidence. And so he's doing life in prison. He's lost his family, his life, everything for 15 pounds of pot. And it's just horrible. And all of his assets seized, and the amount of assets that have been seized over time in this phony war are probably also in the trillions by now. But getting back to Dwayne, he is a guy from the Florida area, and he's got, I've talked to him on the phone several times, he's also the only prisoner that I'm able to have email with. It's really something, and it's been really helpful in our campaign here to be able to correspond in email. We have to watch what we say, and we exchange ideas, and most of our actual correspondence is written. But in email, we're able to coordinate some of our efforts, and it's really been quite magnificent. And I've gotten to know him a little bit better and find out a little bit more about his family. And email can really be kind of helpful in that way, because people have a tendency to loosen up a little bit. But nevertheless, he began to feel, because of the way he was prosecuted and how certain evidence that would have been on his side is completely ignored by the court, and how no matter how he tried to put his best foot forward, it was stomped on. And he was convicted not just for the, quote, crime that he committed, but on a whole bunch of other horrible stuff that wasn't even true. And he ended up getting 26 years. So he's got another 6 years to go. And during this process, shortly after being railroaded into prison on this thing, he began doing the research. And it's been really something. He refers to the statutes under which the federal government is waging its war on drugs as a cryptogram. And 5 years ago when he began corresponding, he was telling me this stuff, and I was getting it. I was reading it. I've read hundreds and hundreds of pages of the thousands of pages that he's put together. And I've come to the conclusion that he's absolutely correct. And when I say that, what I mean is that it's his theory that the whole thing boils down to the definition, which is not defined in this particular statute, of any person. And we'll get to that in a little bit, but mm-hmm. That's the key to the whole thing, is any person. Who is any person? Any person in the universe, any person in America, any person in a state. Who is this any person? And we'll get to that in a little bit. But what he uncovered was the entire process of legal theory that the federal government has utilized in order to wage its war on drugs, and by extension, it uses it to wage its war on absolutely everything else. And the basis of that is what another prisoner named David Summerfield called the clause of all of our problems, and that is the Commerce Clause. And the federal government has decided that any time anything is in interstate commerce, it has enforcement jurisdiction. That even goes back to a case in 1942 when a man, this is during the Agricultural Adjustment Act coming off the Depression, a man planted 6 acres too much of wheat to feed his own family and his own livestock. He was in excess of 6 acres with the quota, and even though he didn't enter any of that into commerce whatsoever, the United States Supreme Court reasoned that it had enforcement jurisdiction over this man because had he not planted that 6 extra acres, he would have gone out into commerce to purchase that stuff to feed his animals and his family. Now, how's that? So in other words, it's absolutely ridiculous. And we have H.R. 875 right now going through Congress, which would require people growing vegetable gardens to license them first because they will be affecting interstate commerce. Because if they are feeding themselves, they're not buying stuff.
I suppose they'll come up eventually with a charge against people who crepitate in public.
because they're adding unauthorized methane or something.
Yeah, exactly. Unbelievable.
No, it is unbelievable. And so what we did is oftentimes people who are – and let me mention another thing, too. During this time, Dwayne has been very, very busy, and he has been orchestrating what is seemingly an unconnected bunch of maybe even frivolous legal filings. Some of them are with his name on them, and some of them are cases that he has helped to others to put forward through the federal system, and even state systems, by the way. And he's been just kind of hitting tripwires and pinging on the issues in order to test his theory. And one by one by one, these seemingly unconnected cases are really kind of coming together and definitely support his theory that the whole thing boils down to the government's interpretation of the word or phrase, term or phrase, any person as it's read into statute. And he's absolutely correct. So he's been working this thing, and what we've done is we've taken his work, and it's taken months and months and months to do it, and we've distilled it down to an article that's about 2,600 words long, and it's available at the Auto Observer website if your listeners are are online at this time, or if they want to pick up a pencil and write it down, go to idaho-observer.com. That's idaho-observer.com, and then just go to the May 2009 update, and the very first category we have in the update is activism, and look at the Doctrine of Constructive Implication and the Federal War on Drugs by Dwayne R. Olson. That's the Doctrine of Constructive Implication and the Federal War on Drugs. It's the article I'm talking about, and at the end of the program, which is coming up, by the way.
We have some time yet.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Very good. I would like people to help me get the word out, because when they see what this is really all about, they're just going to be shocked. And by telling everybody, getting the article out there, maybe writing letters to their local newspaper editors, by talking to people about it, by maybe forwarding this to their congresspeople for what that's worth, or anybody else that can still read and think independently, it will be very helpful. I want the background noise of Dwayne's allegations to be reaching a peak so that we can really get on with finally winning the war on drugs by getting the federal government to freaking surrender.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had attorney, and I have him on, actually, he's going to be on a couple of times this month, attorney Carl Pearson in New York. He's an antitrust and constitutional law advocate for the people.
Okay.
And he practices not just in New York State. He actually ran for attorney general, didn't make it. I think he would be the perfect person to be an attorney general anywhere in this country. He's also a member of the Supreme Court bar. So he has, practiced and argued cases before the Supreme Court. And he's won many victories, against huge corporations. I brought up the term reification because this is the general sense of what they do with the laws. And this is exactly what you're describing when you use the word person. Or when Mr. Olson used the word person, reification is, and Carl had to say he'd never heard of this before. It's to make something which is abstract more concrete or more real. So how do they do that? Well, they do that with birth certificates. Mr. Obama, where's yours, by the way? They do that with driver's licenses, passports, certificates to practice a particular discipline. They do it with the taxes, W-2s or 1099s or whatever form people have to fill out. All of these forms and labels, these terms, these functions, these permissives or these permissions are a result of applying a principle of reification. Now, if it's real, why do they need to make it appear to be more concrete? Why do they need to make it appear to be real? You see, it's not real. It's an illusion. It's smoke and mirrors. It's a magic trick.
Fiction.
Yes, it's a fiction. Exactly. So I wanted to point that out because that's a term Mr. Olson might find very useful.
Well, although sure. I'll definitely pass it on to him. Also, keep in mind, too, that under the present Obama administration, we have a new drug czar. He's a former Seattle police chief named Gil Kerlikowske, and he had comments in a Wall Street Journal article of May 14th, 2009, that indicates that maybe we're already kind of getting somewhere, because even though we're talking about this now, Dwayne Olson has been sending this article, which we refer to as the treatise, to everybody he can think of. And I believe that he's got the ear of some people now. And in the New York Times, or excuse me, in the Wall Street Journal on May 14th, Kerlikowske mentioned that we are not at war with the people of this country. And then, okay, let me back up a little bit. And he was talking about the war on drugs, and then it's counterproductive in addressing the drug problem. And he said, quote, regardless of how you try to explain to people it's a war on drugs or a war on a product, people see it as a war on them. We're not at war with the people of this country. And so we think that maybe the tide is turning, only that maybe the word is getting out, the game is up, and now they're going to try to figure out a way to back out of the drug war as they've been waging it for the last 30 years in a graceful way, and I don't want them backing out gracefully. I want everybody to see exactly what kind of damage that this war has done to the people of this country in terms of assets, in terms of culture, in terms of drug abuse, in terms of rights forfeited, in terms of police powers escalated, in terms of the federal authority overarching everything, which this war has really helped to do, because through waging the war on drugs, the police, the law enforcement at the state and county levels have been given a lot of federal money, a lot of federal training, and a lot of federal toys, which are now in place. And should any kind of form of martial law come to this country, because of this phony war on drugs, we've got a lot of people that are trained and in place to engage in activities that are more paramilitary than they are law and peace enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And I might add that the pharmaceutical companies are complicit in this as well. In fact, the majority of the drugs they manufacture come from the very drugs that are smuggled into the country.
And hence, excellent segue, Mr. Nikoloff, that is exactly where this all began.
Yes.
So let's okay, go ahead, and then I'll try to take a moment or two to describe the background of the federal control of substances and how it's materialized through acts of Congress and the courts.
Yeah, I just want to make one more comment because this has rapidly progressed to include whole foods or organic foods, okay?
Yep.
And vitamins, herbs,
sure.
natural substances. You know, these people are, who are they? Who do they think they are that they can tell us what we can eat or when we can eat? Or how much
like
we have to
tyrant.
Pay to eat.
Any tyrant, they're just going, they are pushing us to the extent of our tolerance. That's
I asked that question again. Where's the birth certificate? Show us the birth certificate, okay?
Right.
We see the game that's going on. Okay, now I'm gonna mute my mic and you can take over. But I did want to add that. So.
No, I'm glad that you did. Okay, it's and again, I encourage everybody to just go to the IO website, that's idaho-observer.com, scroll down a little bit till you get to the May 2009 update. The first category is activism, and look for the article. There's two of them in that category for May, and the second one listed is the Doctrine of Constructive Implication and the Federal War on Drugs. You will be very amazed, and so I'm going to give an encapsulation of the history of federal control of substances and how the federal government invented this war by constructive implication. It's really something, and I think a lot of people are going to, especially people who are over the age of 40 and 50, are going to really be able to relate to this because it's going to involve some events in the past that seemed innocuous at the time, but in hindsight, as we're seeing the carnage, that has been the result of the federal war on drugs, we can see that these things were not innocuous at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so, the federal enforcement of laws prohibiting the manufacture, sale, possession, and consumption of controlled substances is historically rooted in the Food and Drug Cosmetic Act of 1938. And the modern era of drug or substance enforcement came in 1969 with Leary versus the United States. That's Timothy Leary. And also a drug that happened right about the same time. It began before Leary in 69, but ended in 1970 with a Supreme Court decision, which is U.S. or Turner versus the U.S. And in the case of Turner, which began actually in 1967, Turner had some heroin. And he was convicted on several different counts of possessing heroin, but he never took the stand and never admitted that the heroin was from, say, out of country or out of state. And at the time, he would have had to have taken the stand and admitted that to the satisfaction of the, or he would have had to have admitted either tacitly or constructively that he had known that where the heroin came from to have been prosecuted for that or to have been convicted of that. And he didn't take the stand, but he was convicted on that charge anyway. He went to the Supreme Court with that, and the Supreme Court concurred that he did, in fact, he must have known where that heroin came from, that it was out of state because it's heroin, and, you know, heroin obviously is not in the state of New York. But nevertheless, there was that. And then William O. Douglas offered the dissenting opinion, and he stated that, quote, the statutory presumptions unconstitutionally deprive the defendant of the presumption of innocence, cast upon him the burden of proving that he was not guilty, and obligating him to rebut the presumptions tended to compel him to testify in violation of his privilege against self-incrimination in violation of the Fifth Amendment. And so there's a constitutional issue there, and even though there is one dissenting opinion, the Supreme Court upheld that his possession of it is enough to say that he knew that he got it from somewhere out of state or out of country, which invented federal jurisdiction into the case. Okay? So the U.S. government just gave itself a Supreme Court decision that created, you know, that expanded the clause of all of our problems, the Commerce Clause, to be involved in settling out drug cases. Then,
yes.
We have the case of Timothy Leary. In 69, Timothy Leary was coming back from Mexico with a couple of people in his car, and he was stopped at the border, and a couple of roaches were found in the ashtray. So he was arrested and subsequently convicted under the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. And that's marijuana with an H, which is a whole other story. But he was busted for failing to pay the $100 an ounce federal importation tax on marijuana. He was sentenced to 30 years in federal prison in order to pay a $30,000 fine. Upon appeal, he challenged the constitutionality of the Marijuana Tax Act on grounds that it compelled self-incrimination in violation of the Fifth Amendment. The Supreme Court in this case unanimously overturned Leary's conviction, and then upon that event, which I believe places Timothy Leary into a really strange position. A lot of people kind of revere him in many ways, but I think at this point we can say that he was absolutely a player. This was a setup to accomplish what ended up happening, which was Congress then repealed, based upon Leary, repealed the Marijuana Tax Act and passed the Controlled Substances Act of 1970. Passage of the Controlled Substances Act by the 91st Congress is, according to Wayne Olson, the opening salvo in its now infamous, costly, and apparently unwinnable war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we've got a set of circumstances that the feds have gained control over the enforcement of drug laws through a couple of Supreme Court decisions by 1970.
Yeah, isn't it ironic that Timothy Leary, and I think it's Dr. Timothy Leary, right, from Harvard?
Yes.
He experimented and probably supplied the CIA with data about the use of LSD. So
right. We're
talking about a guy that the LSD would have had to have been produced synthetically at Eli Lilly under the direction of George H.W. Bush.
Yeah, with the help of Algie Stevens.
yes. I wanted to add that because that fortifies what you said, that he, you know, that
this
was
staged. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, it's really something. I mean, that was a setup. And so since the passage of the Controlled Substances Act, the federal government has been proceeding as if the 91st Congress enacted a law that made it, quote, unlawful for any person, again, keep that in mind, to possess, manufacture, distribute, or dispense a controlled substance. However, Congress didn't do such a thing and hasn't even ever since. The CSA of 1970, which became Public Law 91513, was codified into the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938 in Title 21, and it confers federal jurisdiction over the right of any person to plant, cultivate, buy, sell, or ingest by whatever method, for whatever purpose, marijuana or any other recreational drug. That's exactly, actually, what it did. It gets to be a little confusing here because of statutory construction, but in essence, what Congress did was gave people, codified the right for any person to do that. We can actually do all this stuff. Now, that's state laws notwithstanding, so don't get me wrong. This is a federal jurisdiction issue that we're discussing here. What the states decide with regard to the consumption of substances they decide to control is a state matter, and it's beyond the scope of our discussion here. We're talking about the federal war on drugs. And what ended up happening, though, is that by this time, in the 1970s, the pharmaceutical industry was exploding with all sorts of new pharmaceutical drugs and stuff, and people were starting to take them like candy, and there were people who were taking advantage of the trafficking of pharmaceutical drugs, because if you take more than the prescribed amount, they can provide, you know, drug experiences that are recreational that the government decided that it was going to gain control over. And they also used the case of a doctor who was licensed, and that's actually what happened here, is that it created a license for people to register with the Attorney General of the United States to engage in commerce in the closed circle of controlled substance commerce. And that commerce is pharmaceutical drugs and stuff. And so people who were regulated by the 1970 Act were the ones who were under the authority of its enforcement and punishment provisions. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself a little bit, but in essence, there became a division between the federal government enforcing, say, registered sellers of pharmaceutical drugs, and then people who are just engaging in recreational drugs was a completely separate matter. But what they did then, and this gets to be rather clever, is the federal government knew what it was doing. It was doing the step-by-step process. And at about the time that Richard Nixon was taking office, there also, if you remember, during that period of time, crime in Washington, D.C. was huge. It was a national, international disgrace, and it was the murder capital of the world, and it was unsafe to go out at night. Everybody remembers all that stuff. I remember from when I was a kid. I even remember it in the 90s when I went to Washington, D.C. for the first time. I was told by people, ooh, yeah, don't go out at night. Well, I've since found out that it's fine if you're in decent company and you go through life with a certain amount of confidence. It's not really a problem. But but nevertheless, they decided that they were going to pass a D.C. crime bill, and they were going to give the police in D.C. additional enforcement authority, additional money, additional search and seizure powers, and those kinds of things to get the crime under control. And they were going to test it there and then expand it out for a national crime control bill. Well, what they did, and this is very, very artful, the Nixon enlisted, he had his chief domestic advisor, John Ehrlichman, and Ehrlichman commissioned a guy named Egil Crow and Don Santarelli, a couple of young college guys with some linguistic expertise, to draft the D.C. crime bill. The plan was to first get the federal crime bill passed in D.C. and then expand it to include the several states. And that's exactly what they did. They put more police on the streets, searches and seizures, arrests, the whole thing began to happen. And then it gained popularity because legislators love this stuff, and it gained shape, and so they changed it to the Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act, and Title II of it was the Controlled Substances Act. Now, here's what they did. They reasoned that crime is rampant in D.C., and indeed, it's rampant throughout the country. A lot of crime, they did some studies and stuff, and they found a lot of crime was committed by drug addicts who were attempting to get money to supply their habits. And then it was inferred that a lot of these drugs, in order to get to these people, was came across state lines. And therein is exactly where the theory of federal enforcement of drug laws came into being.
Mm-hmm. And let's remind our listeners that they are the ones that are transporting the drugs, the government.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not
sure.
Forget
and,
that.
And it's and its favorite and its favorite people in the private sector as well.
Sure, and this thing in D.C. Of course puts the attention on the street people and takes the heat off of them. You know, their
right.
drug parties and their pedophilia parties and their satanic worship. I mean, you know, this, there's enough been written about it and it's been talked about incessantly, but let's just remind the listeners that while these laws are being created to control us, these guys are breaking every one of these laws.
Well, I think earlier in our conversation we were talking about the infrastructure that needs to be in place in banking, government offices, and international law enforcement for all of this to fly. And you can just see that that this is an industry that is frowned upon publicly and end users are busted, but it's a tremendously profitable venture in a lot of different ways. Not just the money that's made, but also a drugged public is not as able to reason and ration and be rational and logical and understand when its rights are being taken away. They're
yeah,
a little
and,
bit too preoccupied.
Yes, and would it be right to say that we can include the oil industry as well in this?
Well, sure, because... another comment that you made earlier in your initial snippet that you read was why you mentioned that why we're not getting very good fuel efficiency. And if you take a look at a barrel of oil, we did a piece in the IO a couple months ago, did some math actually, and found out what comes off a barrel of oil. And you find that really about 35% of a barrel of oil is gasoline. The rest is a variety of products from which we get... asphalt, feedstock for plastics and styrofoams and things like that, and also pharmaceutical drugs and chemicals. And pound for pound or ounce for gallon, gasoline fetches a fairly low price compared to what the gallons of these other products fetch because of their vital necessity in production of extremely expensive products like pharmaceutical drugs. So the reason that we don't have more fuel-efficient cars is because if we did, the gasoline would be accumulating in lakes. So in essence, these guys should be paying us to burn their slag for them. We shouldn't be paying $4 per gallon. They should be paying us to burn their stuff for them. Otherwise, they couldn't justify all these other products that they're cracking off of a barrel of oil.
And so all these people, the government, the pharmaceutical companies, the oil companies, are making enormous profits. When you get into multiplying the cost of some of these pharmaceuticals, it has a factor of 57,000% increase over the cost. That's profit, 57,000%.
That's some profit.
Now, not every one of the drugs they sell is that high, but they're all in the thousands.
Yeah, some of them are pretty dang high. You know, some of these products really fetch a lot of money, you know, because gasoline is an end-use product, right? You crack it off, you maybe add some, you know, horrible chemicals to it or something, but in essence what you have is an end-use product that's just burned up, but all the other products are value-added.
So now we have a Hegelian dialectic that illegal substances are those that they determine they're going to control the importation of and the sales. And then the legal drugs are still the toxic substances derived from those very same drugs.
Yep, you got it. Well, and with regard to the Controlled Substances Act, which is Title II, of the Comprehensive Drug Abuse and Prevention and Control Act of 1970, the late Senator Sam Ervin from North Carolina, who was opposed to it, said, this is really a great comment, this bill is as full of unconstitutional, unjust, and unwise provisions as a mangy hound dog is full of fleas. And yet it passed anyway. And it passed with the help of Senator Roman Huruska, a Republican from Nebraska, and with the blessing of Justice Department's Constitution Law Division and its director, are you ready for this, Assistant Attorney General Bill Rehnquist,
who later became the Chief Justice
of the United States Supreme Court. So he was handsomely paid off for helping to pass this perfidy. And it became, on October 27, 1970, the Controlled Substances Act, as part of the Crime Control Act, became codified as Public Law 91513. So there you have that part of it anyway. And so you can see how they intentionally got rid of the Marijuana Act through Timothy Leary. They decided that anybody that is doing drugs must know that it came from out of state. They got a Supreme Court decision to that effect. And then they invented a way to enforce the Commerce Clause by reasoning that all crime is driven by drugs, and drugs are trafficked in interstate commerce, and therefore drug enforcement authority comes under the Commerce Clause and is to be enforced by the U.S. government, and indeed statutes can be passed in order to justify such enforcement.
Hmm.
Wow.
Now, in the case of this smuggler that agents Ramos and Campion wounded, we'll say, in his posterior, in the area of the wallet.
Yeah, shot him in the ass.
That's one of the former seven words that can be used. It's even used on CNN these days.
Shot him in his donkey. Darn it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Was that drug smuggler, to your knowledge, fined at all or imprisoned for not paying the $743,000 import duty?
Oh, you did the math on that, did you? Marijuana Tax Act has been repealed, so it doesn't apply anymore, Don.
It may have been more than that. I'm just kind of rounding it off on the pound.
No, that was a pretty clever twist of concepts. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, or is it because Leary won his case? I mean, this guy didn't even have to go to court other than to testify against the very people that were doing their duty, enforcing our sovereign territory. My goodness.
No, they stomped on some toes, I guess, and that trade is, I'm sure there's people that get busted at the border, but they're the ones who are the unauthorized entrepreneurs operating outside of the protection racket.
Yeah. Yeah, so that would be an interesting story to pursue further, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, and I haven't, but it would be. But I'm guessing that the border is a little bit loose in that environment, or in that way, because if you look around, I think in the Northwest we don't have a lot of Mexican weed coming up here because of there's a healthy Canadian market player supply line, I guess, but nevertheless, I think a big, huge chunk of the country is rather well supplied by marijuana coming in from various parts south, but through Mexico primarily.
Mm-hmm. Now, a question that comes to mind, and I'm sure there's some listeners that are wondering this. Okay, the original case against Dwayne Olson seems to be really disproportionate to many other cases. And I'm not saying that whether it was 20 years ago or whatever, I don't know what the laws were in Florida, but they seem to be really, really loose. I know back in the early 1970s that it was very dangerous to get caught in the state of Texas. And I know in a particular case, this was the son of an army general that was a friend of a friend, and he had gone on a vacation to Mexico, and he was supposed to be back by a certain date, and it was several weeks before they found out that he had been arrested and given life in prison for a marijuana joint. And I don't know that sentence stuck, but that certainly seemed to be an extreme case. And there you have the world's largest drug dealer living in the state of Texas, eventually awaiting his turn to become president of the United States. Seems to be right. A bit excessive. 15 pounds, you said? That's not even the weight of the average bowling ball. So to do life in prison, and these people are stealing trillions, hundreds of trillions of dollars.
Dwayne got 26 years, and I was referring to a different gentleman that got life.
Twenty-six years is still disproportionate.
It's a crime because he's such a marvelous man. I mean, I talked to him on the phone, and after all this time, he's polite, he's gracious, and he flat has a twinkle in his voice. You see people that have twinkles in their eyes. Well, mm-hmm. he's got one in his voice. It's magnificent. Every time he calls here, I just feel uplifted because this indomitable spirit of this guy. And not only that, after all these years, he's got a circle of friends and family that are still supporting him and still corresponding with him and still visiting him. And that's really an anomaly. I think most guys in prison will tell you that after the first 5 years or so, the letters, the visits, the contact just slowly but surely drops off to nothing. It's mm-hmm. really, really sad.
What was it, do you think, or does he know what it was that got him that kind of sentence? What did he know?
Yeah.
Let me
go ahead and catch you up here, because what happened is, if you remember, during the Reagan era, they passed the Comprehensive Crime Control Act in 1984.
Okay.
And that is where the mandatory minimum for drug possession charges was 10 years in prison. 10 years, mandatory minimum. So if you are, in Texas or Idaho or Florida or the Virgin Islands or Guam, or apparently in some other foreign country, and a federal agent catches you with marijuana or other, quote, controlled substances, then it's mandatory minimum 10 years, and then they can go ahead and start piling the charges on at that point. And at that time, there was a lot of zealousness, because suddenly, let me back up to 1970 really quick. This is the Nixon administration, which subsequently became rather infamous because of all of its shenanigans, but it pulled a lot of stunts before Nixon left office. One of them was to codify the Crime Control Act that had passed, and it was Attorney General at the time, John Mitchell, was authorized to, quote, promulgate rules and regulations relating to regulated persons and regulated transactions. So that's where, if you paid the fee of $500 and signed a contract, you'd be federally regulated under the federal jurisdiction in the closed commercial system of, quote, manufacturing, distributing, or dispensing, quote, controlled substances to the extent authorized by the registration. So, really, the only people that were regulated under the act were those who were registered by the Attorney General. Not people growing weed and selling it on the street or keeping it for their own personal use. That was outside of the statutory construction. The change happens in 1984, and that's when they decided that they were going to expand persons subject to federal drug enforcement, and they just kind of got rid of the regulated persons part of it, and just decided by busting a bunch of people that they're going to create their own case law that made it a federal crime to possess or distribute controlled substances. Again, state laws notwithstanding, back in the 70s or the 80s prior to this, if in Nevada or in Texas there was a capital punishment for possession of a cigarette of marijuana, that was the state's business. Whether it would stand up to constitutional muster on appeal or not is another issue, but the state had its authority to promulgate and enforce laws at its own discretion per the 10th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
But since 1984, this has been pretty well superseded by the passage of the Crime Control Act, and it was during that time there was this flurry of people getting mandatory minimum sentences. Gosh, the federal prison population doubled within 2 years because of this, and it's been escalating dramatically ever since. Over half of the, well, there's 126,000 people in federal prison right now for drugs, according to Dwayne Olson. I'm not certain of that figure, but I'm pretty sure that he's right. And there's been hundreds of thousands that have been caught and released since then, because since 1984, there's been a couple of cycles of mandatory minimum guys that have gotten out in 10 years. And also, in the federal prison system, there is no real good time off, and there's no parole system. So if you're sentenced to 10 years, you do 10 years, period.
Well, they turned it into a business. That's why. They've got to keep that money flowing through on the basis of how many prisoners they have, so they can log up the meals, the guard time, the training time, all the expenses that go along with running a prison, including building new prisons. They've turned it into a real estate venture.
Yes, and half the prisons in this country, that's a loose figure, but half of them are privately operated. Many of them are publicly funded. The operations are publicly subsidized, and the profits are privately accumulated.
Reaps. Yeah, yeah. Well, Don, we've run out of time. I want to give you another moment to state what you would like people to do and let them know how they can get in touch with you or get a copy of The Observer. You do that so well.
Okay, well, thank you. And what we didn't quite get to was the discussion of the offenses and penalties of Section 841 of Title 21, which is the enforcer, the punishment statute, and how the bifurcated and cryptographic interpretation of it is what is really being used. In fact, everybody that gets busted federally and sent to prison for drugs is punished under Section 841. The article that I was referring to that's at our website goes into that, and there's more also that people are just going to find very interesting. I found the history of all this just fascinating, the process whereby they invented federal jurisdiction. But if you go to idaho-observer.com, check out the May 2009 update. The first category listed is activism. The second of two articles in that category is The Doctrine of Constructive Implication and the Federal War on Drugs by Dwayne R. Olson. It's a very important piece. Like I said, the tide is kind of turning. The Obama administration is, I think, a little concerned about us right now because we have solved the cryptogram, and it's a race, I think. They are going to change the rules of engagement in the war of drugs, and I want it to change not to their benefit or for them to bow out of this thing gracefully. I want this thing exposed because it's a horrific crime against the American people. It's given rise to so much law enforcement, federal enforcement authority, the paramilitarizing of our local peace officers, and the searches, the seizures, the forfeitures of property, the ruined lives, the dead people on both sides, and people from all over the world that are being sucked into this any-person nonsense, which has no logical or legal authority whatsoever, is really got to come to an end. So What I want is for people to help me. And I've got so many prisoners I correspond with, and I love it. It's completely important, but it's a monster out of control, and I want fewer people in prison. And you can all help. It's really simple. Grab the article off the site and send it to everybody you know. Everybody. Just go ahead and read it first, and you'll find that it's very lucid, it's very easy to understand, It's complex because of the complexity of the webs that have been woven to justify this perfidy, but nevertheless, it's easy to understand. It gives us a little lesson in history. It brings us to date, and it's time for this war to end and the prisoners of war to be allowed to go home.
Okay, well said. I also want to point out that in light of the RICO statutes and these the federalization of our state laws or the interference with our state laws, using interstate commerce as an example, the government is again with the corrupt banks breaking those very laws, laundering money across state lines. And it's another dimension, but it's directly tied to this drug, the so-called war on drugs, because they're just laundering the money, moving it from one place to another.
Sure.
So I want to thank you for being on Evident Footprints tonight, Don, and I want to let the listening audience know that you will be with us on Monday, the is it the 15th? Yes.
The 15th.
Monday the 15th of June, so I'm looking forward to a follow-up on this. And we did get a call, but we weren't taking any calls tonight. I didn't announce one way or the other. Kathy called in and wanted you to know that she loves us and we're doing a great job. So.
Oh, well, bless her. Thanks, Kathy. And, you know, I would like to actually, in fact, if you don't mind, let's go ahead and announce it now, that on the 15th, I don't know how well you're set up to take callers, but I would
very much
actually to give people an update on our progress on this activism, but also to hear from people, because the drug war has affected everybody. There is nobody in this country that has not been adversely affected by it, even if they don't think it touches them because they don't smoke pot. That's not the point. Look around you. The drug war carnage is everywhere. The rise of the federal police authority is everywhere. The militarization of our local police is everywhere. And it's gone into everything. I mean, the federal government believes that it has the cause of all of our problems to interpret its enforcement of our underwear drawer. I mean, it's completely out of control. And this is really, I think, probably the main force behind this huge rise of federal power is doing it on the drug war, because it's a lot of people think that it only affects drug users.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for that, and that raises one more question. It's a proverbial question, and I've asked it before. Where's the birth certificate?
That's right. Who's your daddy?
Yes. We shall find out, shall we not?
We shall.
Okay. Don Harkins, thank you so much for being on Evident Footprints tonight. We've got to say goodnight. I look forward to your next visit. Say hi to Ingrid. Give her my best, our best, and look forward to the next time.
All right. No, thanks again, Don, for letting me vent this evening. It was really purging for me, and I hope that it was enlightening for the listeners, because it's a very important subject, and I really feel that we can gain some ground on this one.
Yes, yes, we will. And give Mr. Olson our best, too.
I will definitely do that. I'll be able to email him and tell him that we appeared, and he'll be thrilled.
Okay, very good. I'll say goodnight. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and our special guest, Don Harkins of the Idaho Observer. Do get a subscription to the IO. You can do so by calling during normal business hours on Pacific time, 1-208-255-2307, or you can go to their website, idaho-observer.com. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Also our caller, Kathy, and our chat messenger, Drew Raines. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.